he said that it was likely this type of person living in this type of area, traveling in, taking these type of women. But from what I've read, it was largely ignored. And many believe that it would have solved the case sooner, or could have helped solve the case sooner.
This episode of Murder Was the Case is brought to you by the tremendous generosity of our patron, Leah M. You are appreciated. Hey, remember this guy?
Welcome to Murder Was the Case, exploring the darkest, most perverse, and bestial crimes known to man. Tis I, Sir Nate of House Hendley. In this episode, Douglas McGregor of the private forensic behavioral consulting firm Douglas McGregor and Associates gives us a crash course in geographic profiling and environmental criminology. If the prospect of determining where a criminal lives by entering their crime scenes into a software program gets your juices flowing, then stay tuned. This one is far from gruesome, but since everybody has an axe to grind in this age of outrage, here's the obligatory don't listen if anything upsets you. Have your identification ready because we're heading into the dive bar.
So look at this. Black masses, mutilations, mutilations.
We have a weird homicide.
Mountains of skulls and rivers of blood.
As I'm sitting there with a severed head in my hand, talking to it. And I'm about to go crazy, literally. I'm about to go completely flywheel loose and just fall apart.
Once they get in here,
I say, wow, this is insane.
It's over, pal.
We are back in the dive bar with Douglas McGregor, recurring guest now. This is the second time, except this time we're doing it in my place, not in some hotel room in Montreal. Welcome to Toronto, Doug.
Thank you, Lee. Yeah. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah.
Back again.
Yeah, the last little jam that we had, I really liked it. It was one of my favorite episodes, but then it got cursed by that technical failure. So I did my best to save it. But that conversation really gave me a lot to think about. You had an idea of terrorism and I had an idea of terrorism, and they didn't exactly line up. But out of that dialogue, something really useful occurred to me. And that's essentially that we shouldn't look at, I'm talking specifically as like Islamic terrorism, it shouldn't be seen as a monolithic thing like jihadists, whatever you want to call them, are like this. They are all like this.
Right.
That actually it was probably something that needed a typology that didn't have a typology. And all the literature I've been reading on it, it seems to veer in one direction or the other. It's someone going, it's got nothing to do with the religion at all. It's about nationalism. Well, if you do some reading into Islam, you know that those things aren't really separate. And I won't go into that, but they're inexorably intertwined. The idea of an Islamic nation and spirituality,
right,
or religion. But then there is also the people that are going, oh, it's all about religion. And there are cases where that is true. But so many of them, there are little variances within them. Like some of them resemble mass murderers in the classic sense. And I think that that was something that we brought up at the time, like the Omar Mateen thing.
Yeah.
You look into his background, he had this past of all these antisocial behaviors. And I started to think, well, that's important. You know, whether someone has a long criminal history leading up to becoming a terrorist or not is right. important. And if they don't, what does that say? And
right. And if they're a terrorist or if they're a mass murderer, is it their ethnicity or their religion that decides that?
Well, I would say that you can be terrorist, mass murderer. I think that we reached some concord on what terrorism was. That
right.
was sort of like to cause fear to affect a social or political result, something like that, right?
We discussed that because that's what specifically when it came to Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Because in Nevada, that's their definition of terrorism.
Yeah.
Was instilling fear within the public.
See, I think that's way too narrow because literally every act of crime could instill fear in the public. So here we had Bruce MacArthur recently, and before he was caught, and I would say arguably even maybe more so after the fact, terrorized the gay community. But
right.
was he doing that on purpose? We don't know. Was he saying, I'm really getting off on the fact that everyone's scared, or now that everything's been revealed, I'm really happy? I didn't really get that sense off him. But if you go by that Nevada definition, then he would also be a terrorist, as would any person who made headlines for doing a horrific crime. So I felt that was too narrow.
No, I agree. You could look at a lot of cases and they'd all fall into the same boat. And ISIS, in their writings, one of the directions they encourage their acts of violence going, we've seen a lot of vehicle attacks. But mm-hmm. the other thing, one of the other areas that they're emphasizing is serial killer type attacks.
And here's where it gets interesting. So I talked to Detective Cloyd Steiger this year, had a series of long conversations with him, and he worked a case of a jihadi serial killer.
Oh, very interesting.
And that was the first one that I'd heard of. I'd heard of like jihadi spree killers,
right?
But not a jihadi serial killer. And this guy's name was Ali Muhammad Brown. Okay. And he committed a double homicide in Seattle, two gay men. He found that one of them was a Muslim, which may or may not be significant depending on who you ask.
Right.
And essentially, Cloyd's take was just that it was easy to meet gay men and hook up with them through Grindr or whatever it was. And so he had used that just to get two strangers alone. And then he'd shot them at close range with a gun. Right. And he shot another guy who wasn't gay, just some random guy, and then went out to New Jersey and committed a similar homicide there. And so when they got him and they asked him, well, why are you doing that? He's like, well, I was trying to get over to the Middle East, but I figured you may as well kill some infidels while I'm over here.
That's the first case that I've heard of a Islamist terrorism serial killer fashion.
Yes. Right. Yeah. And when they interviewed him, apparently he very much was serious about it. It wasn't something that he took delight in. It wasn't something that he tried to hide from. It was exactly how you would imagine a jihadist, if they lived, talking about their acts.
Right.
You know, just a very dour, solemn, but serious, sincere recount of, this is what I did, and this is why I did it, and I don't apologize.
Very matter-of-factually.
Of course. Yeah. Because it is in service of the truth. I'm not the one in the wrong. That's the way he's thinking.
Right.
Yeah. So, but that's not what we're here to discuss today. But I just wanted to point out, we had a great discussion last time. So anyone who wants to hear that, go back, listen to Terror with Douglas McGregor. That would have been, I think, around April of
2018
that came out. What have you been doing since? You had your amateur MMA career. Last time I checked, you were 2-1.
I finished 2-3.
2-3.
Yeah. 2-3, 2-0 in my weight class, and then I've put the gloves away.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know,
hung up the gloves.
I went to see a cage match in California, and they had some amateurs fighting there too. And just having the balls to get in there in the first place, man, you know, respect to you. And that was a good time to toast.
Yes. Yeah. Definitely.
Cheers. Thanks for coming. So cheers to that, to your MMA.
My short MMA
career,
yeah.
Which was much longer than everyone who talks and only talks. So, to that.
It was fun.
Stressed
out the wife, but it was fun.
Just out of curiosity, those last two that moved your record in the other direction, what happened?
I lost the first two fights. They were out of my weight class. I fought up 20 pounds both times.
Wow. So what is your natural weight class?
165, 170.
So welterweight, if you use UFC.
I'm comfortable in either one of those. The first one I fought up at 190, and then the second one at 180. They were both at my walking around weight, but everybody's dropping weight.
Not your fit weight.
No, not my fight weight. And then I won my next two fights at 170.
Yeah.
So I was 2-2, and then my last fight, I was ready to fight. My fight was at 170. And then 2 days before the fight, the guy dropped out. And then my coach asked me, he said he had another fighter lined up, but he was 160. And he'd ask if I dropped another 10 pounds in 2 days.
No, you can't do that.
I still did. I had trained for 4 months for it, and I did it. I don't make any excuses, but I was drained in the end.
For sure.
Getting into that ring that day, I did not feel good. I had dropped 30 pounds overall instead of just my normal 15, 20.
I'm just amazed that you can lose weight that
quickly. And I lost that fight by armbar.
Yeah. So submission.
Right, right.
Yeah. And was it one of those deals where you kind of saw it coming, but were so tired you couldn't really do much about it?
A little bit. He was a good fighter, good striker. I mean, it went back and forth, but he got the better of me in the end. And It was, again, I don't like to make excuses, but
you remain interesting because you're doing this private consulting thing, yes. Right? Why don't you plug that now?
Sure. My business is Douglas McGregor and Associates. My website is up and running at mcgregorandassociates.com. For my business, I do offer a variety of services from crime prevention through environmental design. I do home safety appraisals. I do missing persons investigations, organizing investigations. I do special investigations as well, where I find people. I'm not a private investigator. I don't have that license. I used to. I gave it up.
Yeah.
I'm not the type of investigator that searches out infidelity or serves subpoenas. I'm not that kind of private investigator.
I thought that would be great.
Yeah, that's where the business is.
Yeah.
No, I do investigative support for cases that I want to take part in. So I'm very selective when it comes to the investigation side of it.
Yeah.
And then I do geographic profiling in support, again, of cases, whether it be privately organized or law enforcement organized.
And geographic profiling, and I think more broadly, environmental criminology is what we're here to talk about today. Before we do, I noticed you've been training your dog to track.
I have.
Very cool. So is that on the list of services coming soon?
It is. And they will be added to the website. We have a husky. She's a year and a half, and a German Shorthair Pointer, who's almost a year old. We've been training both of them on our own and through formalized training, and they will be ready to track hopefully sooner rather than later. They've been working every other day up to a kilometer now, so they're getting pretty successful at it. And it's pretty exciting, and it's fun just to get it with the dogs.
So that's
a good exercise for them, and yeah.
Yeah, you get one, paid, two, to do a good thing, three, with a dog.
Yes, exactly.
Sounds like a dream job.
It is. It's just fun.
Why didn't I think of this before?
So I have the whole organizing the missing persons investigations, and now when it calls for it, can also add in the geographic profiling and the tracking eventually.
Awesome.
So looking forward to making that a big part of the business.
So if any of you require those services, you know where to go.
Give us a call. Give us a ring.
Before we move on, you're also recently engaged. Congratulations.
I am. Thank you. To a beautiful lady, Emma Carney. So, yeah, wedding's next in 2020. We're looking forward to it.
All right, man. So, geographic profiling. Where's the wedding going to be? Did you run that through your computer system?
My parents have a beautiful horse ranch.
So
it's going to be country wedding. Yeah, at the horse ranch. Perfect location.
Sounds like it. Yeah. I like those personal touches to weddings. Yeah. They make a big difference too.
They do.
Geographic profiling for real.
Mm-hmm.
So I know a little bit about it, but I think what I would know about it wouldn't cover more than about 15 minutes, and by no means an expert. So this is really a developing and I think underappreciated area of profiling that in many ways is a lot more useful than the more conventional type of offender profiling that I do. I think that you need both of them, that they work well together, but this is certainly a lot more scientific and software driven. And for that reason, I really want the listeners to be aware of it. And I need your expertise to bring to them. First of all, what is environmental criminology? And then we can move on to the geographic profiling. And, you know, what are its historical roots? If you can speak to that, if you can't, no worries. How does it work? You know, what are the many ways that it manifests or that it can be used? Just take it, man. Environmental crim.
Sure. Environmental criminology. It's a specific branch of criminology. You might find it in some university courses if you take a criminology degree. It focuses on different aspects of the where, of the what and the where and the why. But you can either work off of the victim's environment or you can work off offender's environment. But what you're trying to do, especially when it comes to the geographic profiling side of it, is you're trying to narrow down where the offender is most likely to reside or to work, or their activity space in general, which we can get to in a bit. And this is, it's not to solve crimes, just like offender profiling. It's not to solve crimes. It's to narrow down the focus of the investigation.
The way that I always try and explain profiling, and really any tool that is used in an investigation, it's like, imagine you start with an entire sheet of paper. Now, if you can fold that sheet of paper just in half, that in itself has halved the amount of people that you have to look at. And, exactly. You know, if you use the geo profiling, it makes it a little smaller, with the offender profiling a little smaller. And then you get to a small space. Sometimes I think that's an actual term, isn't it? Small space analysis.
It can be. Yeah. Yes.
You get to a little small space where you go, okay, I'm looking for this type of person in this type of area with the following qualities.
Right.
It's all about making it so that you're not doing what they were doing in a failed investigation like the Yorkshire Ripper case, where they're just grabbing as much information from absolutely every source to the point where they lose track of the information.
Right.
And it actually works against them because they're so swamped with information that they're unable to put it together. You know, there's this morass of it. This is about reining it in more.
And that's just it. And I think law enforcement doesn't quite understand the benefit to profiling, whether it's victimology, whether it's offender profiling, whether it's geographic profiling. And narrowing down the investigation is so critical when it comes to time, mm-hmm. and when it comes to resources. And there's a lot of investigations out there. They have thousands of suspects because mm-hmm. they were this type of person driving this type of car. They have thousands of suspects. But through offender profiling, which you specialize in certain areas, you can narrow that down from 1,000 people to 100. And you know what? Maybe that person's not in that 100,
mm-hmm.
but it's the place to start.
Yeah.
If they're not in there, then you can expand.
It's more about prioritizing suspects.
Correct.
So this idea that an offender profiler is like God playing The Sims or something and just reaches into the ether and plucks out a person that they didn't have any knowledge of before and went, look, him. That's silly. There's always a pool of suspects.
Right.
So it's really about going, okay, well, which qualities do we prioritize mm-hmm. in a suspect to move them up to the either top or the bottom?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're just triaging.
That's when it. Comes you're, to, yeah. you're triaging.
Exactly.
Interviewing, alibiing, forensic tests, basically clearing suspects. That's right. A great way of putting it. Yeah. Offender profiling is triaging which suspects you're going to look at.
You got it.
Yeah.
And the same comes for geographic profiling.
Yeah.
Same idea.
I wouldn't want to have one without the other. Ideally, you want to put them both together.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's why, personally, I don't like the term geographic profiling, which is why on my website, it says geo profiling,
mm-hmm.
GEO, and it's an acronym, which stands for geographic environmental offender profiling.
Mm.
And that's, I put that right out on my website. And then there's also aspects of victimology as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I focus on the geographic, the environmental, and the offender profiling. When you say geographic profiling, most people think of just physical geography.
Yeah.
But the geo profiling involves so much more than just your physical geography. Geography, there's a lot of different branches of geography.
Mm-hmm.
Human geography, cultural. There's a lot of different
physical,
environmental, physical. There's a lot of different branches. But what I'm looking at when I talk about the geographic and the environmental, I look at physical geography. I look at space. I look at place, which are different.
Mm-hmm.
Space is abstract. Place is more personal.
Mm-hmm.
I look at the environmental side of it. I look at weather. I look at time.
Mm-hmm.
I look at human structures when it comes to the physical part of it, not just landforms. I look at demographics, human mm-hmm. geography. Where are humans moving? Who's in this area? Who's in that area? And then offender profiling comes into it as well. I am confident in my skills in offender profiling. But let's say, for example, that I thought maybe this case involved sexual paraphilia.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would consult someone like yourself, who's an expert, to weigh in on this
mm-hmm.
and expand my geographic profile by getting your opinions.
Yeah. And that's the problem with these people that act like they are a walking army of resources. Anyone that thinks that way almost certainly isn't, and they're going to fuck up pretty bad.
Right.
I think that any detective who will tell you that, you know, any case that they've solved, it's always been some sort of team effort. Different people specialize in different areas.
Right.
And so you recognize what you're strong at and what your colleagues and friends and people that you work with are strong at, and you allow those things to result in the strongest possible structure, yes. Investigation structure. Yeah,
exactly.
So what I was really interested in is you were talking about all these different levels at which you do it. And I think the first you mentioned was the physical.
Right.
Can you talk about what it means to look at the physical level of geoprofiling?
Sure. So if we're just talking, let's just start with the physical in terms of what we think of physical geography. So non-man-made physical geography, land formations. If we talk about Kim Rossmo, so Kim Rossmo kind of pioneered geographic profiling in Canada. And in his book, which he uses some pretty good terms in his book, some terminology in his book, activity space and mental maps. I'll talk about those two because they're two of the more important ones, in my opinion, and mm-hmm. they're pretty easy to understand, to grasp. Activity space. We all have an activity space, an area that we carry out our daily activities. We work, we live, we play.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those all have boundaries, and this comes to physical geography. Now, those boundaries may be a river. It may be a lake. It may be an ocean. It may be a mountain range. They contain us. We work, act, and play. This is just on the
physical level.
This is just on the physical geography level. So we act, work, and play within those. And this is just one aspect of the physical level.
Yeah, because I'm already thinking of other boundaries, but let's stick to physical.
There's lots of boundaries. Yeah. This is just the physical geography. Yeah. We rarely cross rivers, even though something might be 5 minutes away from us. We rarely cross bridges, cross rivers to go and carry out our activities over there.
Or I'm thinking if you have one path where I have to go uphill
right.
versus a path where I have to go not uphill.
Path of least resistance.
Yeah. And this is where, once again, knowing the offender and knowing the victim is useful because there are people that will choose the hill because they do it habitually to get in shape. But I imagine those are right. few and far between. Most people are going to avoid the hill.
Yeah. And that's an aspect of geographic profiling as well. When a criminal flees a scene and it's on a hill, 9 out of 10 times they go down the hill. And that's just an aspect of physical geography, path of least resistance. So when we look at the physical geography, we're looking at landforms, we're looking at barriers, mental barriers, whether it's, like I said, a river, a lake, we're looking at land formations. Maybe it's a peninsula, maybe it's an island.
Mm-hmm.
So all these different things can weigh in on the behavior of the offender and how they act in that environment. Also comes into play with physical geography is how humans manipulate that geography. And that changes things
mm-hmm.
exponentially. Do we put in a highway? We've just created a mental barrier.
Yeah, if you highway, put in a highway is a river of cars.
Exactly. Yeah. Even a railroad creates a mental barrier.
Yeah.
People rarely cross railroads to the other side of town. If we create a 2-lane road into a 4-lane highway, if we take out streetlights, there's just many different ways that we can manipulate the physical geography to change your behavior.
I see what you're saying, but streetlights to me seem a bit different because streetlights, they're a barrier where it's not so much like, I can't cross this highway. You know, it's a 4-lane highway. I can't get across it. So I'm not going to attempt to. I'm going to go around it or I'm going to take some other route. But when you say like, hey, maybe in this area, there's no streetlights. It's not that I couldn't walk through the area with no streetlights. I could, perhaps with some difficulty, and I might risk falling or whatever. But what comes into play there a bit more, too, even though we're talking about the physical geography, which is the absence of streetlights, is that something may occur, something negative may happen to me in that space. So the absence of streetlights enables a likelihood of predation, that I may become the victim of predation.
Yes, it does. That all plays into crime prevention through environmental design.
Yeah.
How we make our environments safer by manipulating them, by changing them. When I talked about streetlights was one aspect of it. Yes, if there's an absence of streetlights, it can increase the potential of crime. Something like traffic lights, though. Traffic lights, you can change human geography and human behavior by either putting them in or taking them out.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a street that has traffic lights, you make it wider and take out all those traffic lights and put in underpasses and overpasses. You've just changed where all the humans are able to cross
mm-hmm.
and you've put in a mental barrier because you created a bigger road. If you take those traffic lights and you put in certain ones have crosswalks and certain ones don't, you've also changed human behavior. So when I'm doing geographic profiling, it's not just looking at the macro level.
No.
It's getting down to the micro level and seeing how humans are affected by their natural and physical and man-made environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So even something like a bike lane can make a huge difference.
Big difference.
Yeah. If you have a street with a bike lane versus a street that doesn't have a bike lane, and let's say both are busy streets, the cyclist is more likely to pick the one with the bike lane.
Correct. And bike lanes also change the dynamics of a city, because as soon as you add in a bike lane, you bring people to that area of the city. So an area of the city that might not have had a lot of people, you add in a sidewalk, you've just brought people there. You add in a bike lane, you bring more people there.
You bring a different type of people there. Sure. You bring in people that are cyclists and they have various maybe belief systems about health or environmentalism or whatever. I'm thinking too, then you can use this idea of you build an overpass, or okay, so you do that, you create a potential place where people can be under the overpass.
Right.
You know, you create areas where vagrants or users or people of maybe that are doing something more furtive might gather. So this is all very interesting. Like, I don't think that SimCity ever got quite this far, did they? In that, even putting in something like a bike lane or an overpass, it doesn't just change the way that people move. It changes the type of people in that location.
It does.
And that's the human element of it?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a large human element of it. That's the element on the micro level.
Mm-hmm.
If you looked at a town, a city from bird's eye view, humans just move like ants in an ant farm. We can decide where ants move in that ant farm by making new paths, new routes.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing that we do with cities or towns.
Mm-hmm.
That's the micro view. The macro level of the geographic profiling at the human geography demographics level is who lives in this type of area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we get a lot different. If we go to British Columbia, the type of person who lives in British Columbia is a lot different than the type of person who lives in the East Coast or in Ottawa. That's just culturally from city to city or from across the country. That's not even taking into account ethnic lines, religious lines throughout the country.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of Canada out loud right now. So for our American listeners, here's a chance to get a little tour of Canada too. And for your Canadian listeners, you're going to be indulged here. But it's interesting. So I think of Vancouver, where I've been a couple times now.
Mm-hmm.
And Vancouver is very like, within 5 minutes, you can be into a wilderness zone.
Yes.
And I'm not talking about some designated public park area. I'm talking about real wilderness where you might see deer or something like
sure.
that. And it's also got that aspect where you're close to the sea. And at the same time, you can move from that wilderness zone to like the urban center really quickly. Now, Montreal, where I lived for many years, stands out to me because the neighborhoods are so different. It's like you're in one neighborhood and it's all brown brick and it feels like you're in the Industrial Revolution.
Old Montreal.
Yeah, well, there's Old Montreal, yeah. But I was thinking more like Point St. Charles.
Okay.
Yeah, which is not really a tourist destination, but it's kind of cool down there. You know, very brown brick. It looks like Coronation Street or something like that, right? And it's got the people that live down there, because the rent is low, they tend to be more working class, and you get a mix of Anglophones and Francophones, because it's not so much about the community, based on my experience, unless I'm missing something, it's more about, well, we can afford to live down here and they keep it real. You know, there's my fish and chip shop. There's where mm-hmm. I go to get my smokes. And of course, there's like the train that runs through that area. And then you get, say, the Plateau or Mile End, which became very hip. Now, these were old places where the Jewish community used to live. And so they were kind of low rent. There's lots of delis. And then you had artists move in there because they're low rent and you don't make a lot of money doing art. And then they make those areas hip. They change those areas. They mm-hmm. draw a different type of people. And then those areas become expensive. It's a gentrification thing, and they have to move out. So even just looking at like those two cities there, you can see how human beings and their geography interact and how the two almost like influence each other.
They do. Humans can change geography and geography can change humans.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah. So it's like once upon a time, if you were going to look for, say, an attractive middle-class female victim in Montreal, you probably wouldn't go up to Mile End.
Right.
Now it would be a prime location.
Right.
And that's got to do with the whole gentrification aspect of
right.
it. Right. Yeah. So, yeah, this is how complex this gets. So this is often mapped out on a software program, right? Is there one that you favor to use?
I use Google Earth Pro a lot. Mm-hmm. There's different reasons I like Google Earth. On top of its many features, it also has the time lapse. So if I'm working cases today, easy. But if I'm working cases from 10, 15, 20 years ago, I can go back in time and I can see what those cities looked like. Mm-hmm. So that's a big advantage of Google Earth.
How far back does it usually go?
I think it can go back to 1939. But that all depends
on... Some cities, probably.
Some cities, yeah, yeah. Exactly. And not just some cities, but some... it depends on how far you zoom in, zoom out. So, mm-hmm. But you can go back in time. And even just going back... If it's a 20-year-old case, going back 10 years can give you a better idea of what that geography was like at that time. On top of that, I use ArcGIS as well. That's kind of, Google Earth is my starting point. There's a lot of geographic profiles I can do just off Google Earth. But then ArcGIS is kind of adds that next level as well. It's another mapping software that allows you to really get down and it allows you to create different things like paths, routes. You can create buffer zones. Mm-hmm. So there's just a lot of different features that it has that Google Earth does not have.
So let's say there's an area where it's known that there's a bunch of scumbags that live here.
Right.
And someone would avoid that area based upon scumbaggery.
Right.
That's not going to be on Google Earth.
No.
Is it on the other program?
You can put that into the other program.
What do you call that? It's certainly not scumbaggery.
Well, okay, here's an example. A buffer zone is a great one that you can put into the other program. So you could probably give me a specific example. I'm just going to speak hypothetically here.
Yeah.
Take a certain type of crime. Let's just take burglary, for instance. And I'm just speaking hypothetically. You can correct me. Let's just say that 90% of the time, somebody who's committing a burglary doesn't do it within 50 yards or 100 yards of their residence.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now you can plot in where the burglaries happen and you can put a buffer zone that is 50 or 100 yards around a certain area and then they could live in there. And then you only include those burglaries that happened outside of that buffer zone.
Hmm.
So there's different features that you can apply criminology and different statistics to.
So it seems to me that you would need some knowledge of the community too. You couldn't just open up your software program, you know, look at the map and just go, well, this appears to be the points of the crime, because then you're not knowing, well, that scumbag street.
Right. Or,
so you do need to do some cultural research too, some like anthropology or something. What would you do in a case like that? Would you call the local police department and say, hey, I'm doing a geographic profile. Do you want to tell me where all the shitty people live?
not quite so simple. There's a lot of different data that you can download for ArcGIS, different statistics, law enforcement statistics, and you can apply it. You can upload it right into there, and it could be crime data from across the country. You might want crimes committed in this city, so you can get this information. It's not too hard to get. There's different sites on the internet that you can get this from, and it uploads right into ArcGIS. Mm-hmm. So right away, you can have every burglary, every theft, every arson just uploaded on there. So this program, ArcGIS, can do a lot of this program. I'm not here plugging in for ArcGIS. I don't get paid by ArcGIS. There's other programs too, but it's my favorite software.
Good product sells itself.
Yeah, exactly. Along with Google Earth. Those are my two favorite softwares that I use.
Really? So you get that ArcGIS, and it's... like, there was an arson here on this date. There was an arson here on this date. There was an arson here on this date.
Yes. It's like Ottawa Police has a Ottawa Police crime map app. I'm sure Toronto Police, they might as well. I don't know. And it's basically just that. You just upload the data and it just pops up on your screen on the map.
Okay. So ArcGIS doesn't do it for you. You have to upload the data.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. And so that could be useful if you are, in this example, looking for a serial arsonist. Like, where does he live? in relation to where these fires have taken place.
Exactly.
But it also can be useful in, hey, there is a lot of, and arson won't work in this example, but say you were using muggings.
Okay? Sure.
There are a lot of muggings in this area. Presumably most people who live here know that. Therefore, people are likely to avoid this area unless they are someone who is unlikely to avoid that area, which makes them a certain type of someone, which is either someone who is comfortable moving in that area or someone who is very naive or drunk or whatever.
Right. And all this information I use for SEPTED as well, which is the crime prevention through environmental design, and urban planners, city designers. Mm-hmm. They all use this information in order to modify the city. City, urban, rural environments to eliminate crime.
Hmm. Yeah, so you were talking about Rosmo pioneering this, and he did so in Vancouver, right? This was his PhD in, was it criminology, something like that?
Yes. Don't quote me on that.
I think it was
PhD in, I think it more math-related statistics and criminology.
Yeah.
But don't quote me on that.
Yeah, it was like quantitative style criminology, not like the more qualitative stuff that I do. But there's a story behind that.
So he was at Vancouver Police Department. From my understanding, he spent most of his career there. The big case that most people would know of that is attributed to him is Picton. However, he wasn't listened to.
Robert Picton, the pig man who killed, well, he was convicted of killing six sex workers on his property, but there was DNA evidence of 31, if I recall correctly, and he had said that it might have been up to 49 victims. But that might have been just him boasting. But the fact is, this person killed a lot of women.
And Rosmo worked on that case, and he presented a geographic profile that many believe would have caught Picton sooner had they listened to him.
That's interesting, because Picton's place was out. It wasn't in Vancouver.
No. Right?
And they didn't know where any of the bodies turned up, because that was the thing. They were all missing. It wasn't like they were known homicide victims. It was just presumed that they were homicides because they were missing.
Right.
So he had looked at the places where they went missing from, those locations, presumably, correct, or were last seen, and then arrived at, it's this property in, I think it's pronounced Port Coquitlam.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
And from his profile, I'm not sure of the intricacies of the profile and everything that's said in the profile,
mm-hmm,
but from what I understand is that is relatively correct, is that he said that it was likely this type of person living in this type of area, traveling in, taking these type of women. But from what I've read, it was largely ignored. And many believe that it would have solved the case sooner, or could have helped solve the case sooner.
Well, even worse, for his efforts, Rosmo got demoted. Rather than going, hey, thanks for doing all this, we're not going to actually listen, but you did go above and beyond, so you can either stay where you are or we'll promote you for that. They actually punished him. They were going to knock him down a peg on the Vancouver Police Department hierarchy. And at that point, he just kind of went, fuck this. And he left. He became a professor in Texas. I think it's either University of Texas, something like that. And now he's like one of the most respected criminologists in the world. And turns out he was right.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's the story of Rosmo's method, which is, I believe, the one that you use, right?
It's the one that I started on and that I refer to the most. And it's the one that I kind of develop my own methods off of. Mm-hmm. It was the foundation of North American geographic profiling.
Right.
Which differs from European geographic profiling, because North American cities, North American living spaces are built differently than European spaces. And we think differently than Europeans, and we act differently culturally.
Yeah.
So it is the foundation of North American geographic profiling.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Like when you said we think differently, I don't think that we think vastly differently. So you meet someone from Europe, it's not like it's impossible to get along with them. You have no reference point.
No, not in that sense.
But in the sense of, and most people don't realize this until they've spent some time in Europe, or if you're in Europe, have spent some time in North America, it's the relation to surroundings and distance, that sort of thing. So one of the big things is the grid system here, obviously, right? Like everything, because it was built with the idea, I think, of traffic flow beforehand, right? Before they made all these snaking paths that were just pedestrian only, or maybe donkey and cart or something, and then later had to become streets. The idea was that you start with the streets in the new world. And because it's also so vast, you have the space to put it on this grid system. So North America, generally people know that way's north, or because you have some reference point and you go, okay, because all the streets are on a grid, if that's that direction, then I know the rest of the directions.
That whole grid system, like we said, is not only for, it's for traffic flow and human flow. But it allows, and in this sense, it almost makes, it can add complications in when I do a geographic profile, because you have more than one route to get to the same place, mm-hmm. or more than one efficient route to get to the same place. And the reason the grid system was implemented, one of the reasons was for that purpose. So if one route was closed, you still could get there through another route. It didn't disrupt traffic.
Mm-hmm.
So you have more than one route to get to the same place. So that can prove a difficulty when mapping out somebody's potential route, because it could be multiple routes. Whereas in the European system, and you can explain it, you've spent quite some time in Europe. It's not quite like that.
In Europe, people think about their geography and the routes they travel more from a point of view of familiarity, and that's because the streets are generally more snaking. They're not at all on a grid system. So what you just get used to is, you know, I travel down this path. There is really no other path. I mean, there might be one other that I could take, but why would I? And yeah, it's like you might maybe make note of the houses along the path a little bit more. You certainly, in most cases, won't know where north, south, east, and west are, or what direction that you're traveling in, unless you're someone who specifically thinks about that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. People are thinking more on a pattern of what I would say is just familiarity in Europe. I'll give you an example of this. I was lost in Vienna, and I stopped a couple people on the street because I just needed to know which direction to go, and I didn't mm-hmm. want to keep going in the wrong direction. And I just said, do you know which way south is? Right. And nobody had any clue whatsoever. If you were to do that in Toronto, where we currently are, you might meet some people that are just like, what? Right. But someone's going to pretty quickly go, oh, well, this way is north, right? And you can always orient yourself in Toronto by, you go, well, where's the CN Tower, which is almost always south.
Right.
So it's beyond it being a landmark, it's almost like a little point on the map where you go, well, that's there, so that must mean I'm here.
Right.
And in Europe, they just don't think in those terms, like north, south, east, and west. Even the roads, you know, we have the 401 highway in Canada. And what I love about it is you can just, at some point, when the traffic clears, the traffic's the biggest problem with the 401. I don't know if you know this, one of the most dangerous highways in the world.
Was on there today.
Yeah, especially in the snow, right? It's terrifying. But at some point, you can usually just chill, unless it's a really busy day. If you're driving it long enough, you can go, all right, I'm going to throw on the cruise control, and I'll just sort of chill out. And the road will kind of bend a little bit, you know, every few minutes, but whatever, I'm good.
Right.
In Europe, constantly turning, constantly in motion, no time to chill. There's no part where you can kind of deactivate your brain and go on autopilot. And so I think that also plays out in what I've noticed is that in Europe, people are a lot less inclined to travel even what we would consider short distances by car. So people who live in Liverpool will go, well, I don't go to Manchester. You know, that's like half an hour away.
Yeah.
Which to most North Americans, it's like my dad would drive an hour and a half to work
mm-hmm.
every day. And it's not that he liked it, but we're just used to that kind of thing. I mean, who would expect to be within half an hour travel to their work? You know, very lucky person in North right. America, right?
Yeah.
So just those things alone. Yeah. It's like if Cantor's system which did we mention Cantor yet?
I don't think we did. Not his name, no.
No, so we're getting to David Cantor. But David Cantor, he's an English guy. He developed another system of geographic profiling. If he developed that based on data in Europe or in the UK, and Rossmo did his based upon data in North America, for those reasons alone, I would be inclined to use the systems that are native to those continents.
Definitely. And I'm not an expert on Cantor's system. I don't know it as familiar with it as I am with Rossmo's, but he applies a lot of what you were talking about, just the spatial awareness of Europe. Just kind of going on a tangent, talking about that is that when you were talking about those, the curved streets, those really mess with our own individual spatial awareness. If we're in Toronto, like you said, or New York City or Ottawa, and you ask, where are you? Which direction are you pointing? Like you said, northeast, southwest, no problem. But once you add in curved streets, people very quickly lose that awareness of where they are geographically on a map. And if you ask, it's really, really interesting, because if you actually ask somebody to draw out their city or their town, those roads that are curved will be very far off from what is reality. Because they can't picture it. They can only picture the straight lines. So they change your spatial awareness and they change how people react and behave in those environments.
Right. Before you mentioned that you can look at geographic profiling from the point of view of the victim of a crime or the perpetrator of a crime, and I'm guessing the third option is to look at it as yourself, the omniscient narrator, right, or whatever. Can you talk about what it's like to look at it, first of all, from the point of view of a victim of a crime?
The victimology. I really enjoy victimology. I took several victimology courses through Algonquin College. They have a victimology program there. Get a case, and I'm asked to do a geographic profile. The victimology, looking at it from the victim, is always very, very important, because it's the key point, geographic point on location to start with. It's just a very important geographic location. Where was that victim first approached? Where was that victim killed? Where was that victim disposed of, the body disposed of or found?
Last seen, probably.
Last seen. Yeah. So all these points, the more I know, the more it helps me create a more accurate geographic profile. But I also look at other aspects of the victim as well. So, you know, where they frequented, where they lived,
their habits,
yeah, you know, where they worked, their habits in terms of what they did during the week, what restaurants, what bars they frequented, what areas of town, if they have a best friend's house they go to on a regular basis. The more information you know and can plot in on a map, the more accurate a profile you can get or idea you can get of where the offender may have crossed paths with this person. Because basically what you're doing is you're creating an activity space for the victim and then an activity space for the offender. And generally those activity spaces will cross at some point.
They're going to intersect.
Right.
So if we can determine that every day Lana walks home from work along Marlborough Street, then turns onto her community road, which is residential, and walks three houses and goes into her own house. Then if it's the type of crime where it seems where Lana may have been stalked or selected, then we can say, okay, well, who goes into Lana's work, because I mean that's where you're going to start, right? I did say walks home, I meant from work, if I wasn't explicit there. So who comes into Lana's work, but also who can see Lana walk down Marlborough Street, you know, so who frequents businesses there, has businesses there, who commutes along there, and also that little stretch of residential area. And so once again we're taking that large space and making it smaller again as far as the pool of suspects that we prioritize, right?
That's exactly.
Yeah.
And it can be any number of interactions. It could be this suspect drives down this road every day to get to work. And it could be the victim gets their bus stop is on that road. So every morning that suspect drives by and sees her. standing mm-hmm. there at that bus stop, or every afternoon coming home. So there's where that interaction was made.
Yeah, it's also the spot where the genesis of the fantasy, where that person specifically becomes involved in a fantasy and or plan, happens as well.
Right.
Yeah.
So any of those kind of interactions. So the victimology, the victim's activities, is just as important as the suspect's.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about looking at it from the suspect's point of view? That's kind of what you're alluding to there, right? But that seems harder because we know who the victim is,
right?
But we don't know who the offender is. So how do you look at geographic profiling from the point of view of an offender whose identity you don't yet know?
There's several different ways you can apply geographic profiling. So from an offender you don't know, what you can do is you can plot all the information you do know into a map, take into account any number of things that I mentioned previously, and you can narrow down the area where they most likely reside. Or you can narrow down, maybe it's not even where they reside. Maybe you don't have enough information for that. Maybe you can narrow down their activity area. So then you can monitor these areas. If it's an offender, let's say you have a list of 10 suspects.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you plot all those suspects onto a map plus your victim, and only one of them intersects their activity area, then you have a better idea of who it may be. So there's different ways you can use it depending on the information that you have. An offender that you don't know, it will all depend on how much information you have as to how narrow of a focus that you can create from your geographic profile.
Hmm.
And some of that information will be moot. Some of that information won't matter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you have to filter that out. And some of that information can throw your geographic profile completely off, even if it was one of their, let's say they murdered any number of people. One of those murders, even if it was theirs, if you apply it, it can throw off your geographic profile. So using what you know, you have to apply the ones that apply the most. I'll give an example. The Russell Williams, when he was sneaking into girls' houses in Orleans, right? One of them was on the other side of the river, wasn't it? One of them. But he said afterwards that was just an opportunistic, right? If you had applied that, it might have changed it slightly.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is that I was thinking of this as you were saying it, the crimes are very dynamic, and so is planning a crime. In fact, the one movie I say that everyone needs to watch is Dial M for Murder, because in a very charming little 50s or 40s way, it shows that even the best plans, there's one little variation in it, it can throw everything off. So perhaps you have a offender who has their mind set on getting a certain victim, and on the day that they're ready for it to happen, the victim doesn't show up where they're expected to, or there's some change in the routine, and then they panic because they're all worked up, and they maybe drive to another area seeking someone who looks similar, or they, I'm thinking in the case of Dennis Rader, just cross the street to the next house.
Right.
You know, there is a dynamism to crime that I'm not sure that stats always are able to pick up.
No, they're not. And that's where the human element comes in. And, and that's why you can't apply everything to a formula, is because you have to be able to analyze these components, these aspects of it, and say, this is out of the normal range of their activities. And if you have to be able to see that and take that out in order to have a more accurate picture. There was a serial killer in California, and they had one murder that was far north in California. And in the end, it was attributed just to a crime of opportunity. They had traveled north. In that instance, you just got to know, okay, you take that out. You cancel that out.
And the area where these activities can happen, because you said it's not necessarily where they reside. It could be, say, where a friend or girlfriend lives, or a mother lives, or where they work, a place that they're particularly fond of or drawn to, those sorts of things too.
Definitely. Yeah. You know, you can have someone that commits crimes in one side of the country and they, like you just said, they fly to the other side of the country just to meet somebody or to go visit a relative and they commit a crime while they're there. Well, you're not going to include that in your geographic profile because it doesn't fit the pattern.
And it's unlikely that you would anyways because it's so far out.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. I would also like to talk more generally about environmental criminology and this idea of hotspots. So this is sort of like, it's not so much about catching someone.
No.
What is this more about? Like predictive policing or?
That's exactly what it is. That's one component of it. A hotspot is anywhere where crime is more likely to occur.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a red light district. It can be residential housing areas.
Mm-hmm.
So there's different areas where it's more likely to occur. And a lot of it, the hotspots usually fall in line with target backcloth, mm-hmm. right? If you have a large target backcloth, where do you have a lot of people? You have a lot of people at malls. So there's going to be more pickpocketing at malls. It's a hotspot for pickpocketing, let's say, or public events. There's a concert. Well, you might have more pickpocketing there. It's a
opportunity, number of opportunities.
Yeah. So the larger the target backcloth, the greater the hotspot for certain types of crimes.
Mm-hmm. But there's also got to be another element to it too, right? So are you more likely to sell drugs in the area of town where there is a transient down and out population? Or, and I guess when I'm saying drugs, I'm that's crack, okay. Or at the mall. There's more people at the mall.
Right.
But you're not going to...
Where's your clientele?
Where's your clientele? Sure. And also those control measures that we talked about earlier, the broken windows effect. You know that you start selling crack in the mall, they've got those cameras, they've got security guards, they've got, when we talked about before, about the houses, mm-hmm. keeping an eye on each other's house in the neighborhood.
Right.
We know that people are going to keep an eye on in a mall, you know, a very middle class, safe area. Stereotypically, people are going to be watching out for that, but they're going to turn a blind eye, on the other hand, on the shady part of town.
Of course. Yeah. And SEPTED and urban design, city planning can all, gentrification, de-gentrification can all change where these hotspots occur and where they move. So you can move these hotspots around. It's unlikely that you're not going to eliminate all of them, but you can move them.
Well, that's what interests me about what you were just saying. There's always going to be a hotspot.
Right.
So who makes the political decisions and how is it made as to where that hotspot gets to be this decade?
Well, as a city planner, I'm going to move them out of any tourist district.
Right.
And out of any upper middle class district. And so there's different ways I'm going to move them, but those are decisions at the city planning level. But that's at a more like a bigger picture level. But mm-hmm. you can move them just little things in schools too, or in communities, in malls. You can move them around depending on what they do. So you're not going to eliminate them all, but you can move the target hotspots. But the hotspots are also going to follow your backcloth.
And because there's always going to be these hotspots, it just occurred to me too that if we're thinking about space, and I don't mean outer space, I just mean a space right. where crime can be committed. Now we've got to look at cyberspace.
Yes. Right?
Like the dark web, virtual reality.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if they're pushing hotspots out of the real world, they're going to push them into these other spaces.
Right. They're already in there.
Yeah, right. They have to be there. Yeah. So maybe it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. Like you have to make a choice to travel down into the dark web. And it's not an easy process to get down in the dark web. It's not difficult either, but
no.
But it's a lot harder than just walking into the wrong part of town.
Right. And you don't even need to be in the dark web to find this stuff. Online gaming. It's in online gaming. All these real world online game simulations
mm-hmm.
where you can use your avatar and you can walk in and buy a shirt from this store and you can try it on with your avatar and it gets mailed to your house. Those same games, there's the black market as well. And law enforcement, intelligence, they have avatars, people that play these games, that are in these games to prevent this.
Wow, that's fascinating.
That create these contacts within these games. And I learned this when I was out at BCIT. But so it's everywhere. And the cyber realm applies to my geographic profiling, and it's just that other dimension. You know, it's working in that other dimension. And I'll give an example. Just a little while ago, there were a string of bomb threats in Kingston. They were all directed at schools in the Kingston area. There was about 9 of them in total. It was one in Ottawa as well. And I was contacted by the news, and I was on the news, and I did a segment on the news as to where I thought this individual was. And I said they likely had a strong connection, possibly resided within this area, based on the first school they contacted. I said they likely had a relationship with that first school. Mm-hmm. And I said, if they lived in Kingston, they lived in this area located towards that first school. It ended up being that the individual actually lived in the UK, but they had first contacted kids from that school. So they had an online geographic presence, if you will, with that school in that direct area that I suggested, but they didn't themselves reside there. They resided over in the UK.
They had first contacted kids at that school, correct, which they threatened to bomb. I'm missing the motive part.
It was a thrill. The kids said, hey, can you send a threat to our school kind of thing? Right. And then it just got out from there. It got on Twitter, and kids were saying, oh, can you threaten our school? Can you threaten our school? And it just went from there, and he kind of became this little mild celebrity. And now they're not arresting him or sending him to Canada, but he's not allowed in Canada anymore. He was 16 years old. And then somebody on social media from Ottawa said, hey, can you threaten my school in Ottawa? And I think there was 9 schools or something threatened, but I was wrong in the sense that he didn't reside in Kingston. I was right in the sense that he had
the location. The first school.
Yeah. First school was critical, and the first contact was this location, this area. So I
think one of the best ways that's articulated actually in popular media is in The Silence of the Lambs, when Hannibal Lecter says to Clarice, you know, what is it that we covet? And this is something that she puzzles over, and she says, we covet the things that we see in day-to-day life. And that's how she makes the connection that the killer likely lived in the same geographical proximity as his first victim. Mm-hmm. And that's how she ultimately finds him.
Right.
It's kind of a very rudimentary geographic profiling. Mm-hmm. Another thing which I think we must touch on, though I have commented on the show about it before too, is the broken windows effect, which in a way goes back to a very old school model of criminology. When you go into an area and you see people, shooting up, or you see graffiti everywhere, or you see homeless people drinking on the street, it doesn't matter what your moral judgment is about that. The fact is that a criminal sees that and they say, well, this is an area where I can get away with things.
This episode of Murder Was the Case was produced by Lee Meller, featuring music by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. You'll find part 2 of my talk with Doug McGregor waiting in your podcast app, so spin that shit, dog.
Psst! It's Nate Hanley. Lee would go ballistic if he knew I was telling you this, so just let's keep it between us, okay? Rather than spending his hours kissing the asses of various university faculties so they can exploit him, tell him what he can and can't say, and work him into the ground without even the prospect of getting tenure, Lee is focusing most of his energies on Murder Was the Case, so that he can educate as many people as possible in the manner he sees fit. If you value this show, support it on Patreon at patreon.com/murderwasthecase.
Broken glass everywhere, people pissing on the stage, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise, got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front.